distributing the future broadcast October 16th, 2006, getting involved.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. The seasons are changing once again. Here in the U.S., it's election season. Are you sufficiently involved? Tom Steinberg of My Society talks about some of the tools available in the U.K. Too real for you? Well, Jim Perbrick talks about creation and community in Second Life. Today we're talking about the intersection of the real world and the virtual world. In the second half of the show, we'll hear about people who immerse themselves in Second Life and create a different sort of world in which to live. In this half, we hear about what you can do to get politically active to make the actual world that you live in into a different sort of place. Both parts come from keynotes delivered in Brussels at the O'Reilly European Open Source Convention, EuroOSCON. I was hanging out near the registration desk when Tom Steinberg checked in. Now, I know we aren't related because my family changed its last name from Trachtenberg to Steinberg to get into the U.S., but still, it's hard not to look up when someone you share a last name with introduces himself. Tom is the founder of My Society, which runs a variety of democracy websites in the UK. During his keynote address, he introduced several different sites. Many of the politicians that Tom helps everyday people access spend their lives talking out of both sides of their mouths. In the keynote, Tom did it on purpose. For example, he shows off the website writetothem.com using his public persona.
So people who want to write to a politician put their postcode in this box and they press go in order to write to it. It will tell them who their politicians are.
Meanwhile, his private inner voice looks at the page and thinks,
this page doesn't look anything like anything you guys run. What's wrong with it? There are no pleasingly multi-ethnic families taken from photo archives. It's so empty. And it's so obvious what you're supposed to do. Something can't be right there.
So I gave it a try with a UK postcode for a place I'd lived in for a year nearly 30 years ago. After a few moments, I got a list of the district councillors and county councillor for Kennington, as well as the members of parliament for Oxford West and Abingdon. I was also given links to the 10 southeast members of the European Parliament who represent that district. Following an experimental link, I was even able to locate a member of the House of Lords interested in a topic or a district, although I was advised that, quote, Lords do not have a duty to reply to the public, and they are obviously not elected, end quote. The website was surprisingly easy to use, but is it necessary? Tom says that sadly it is, as...
Actually, only about 3 in 10, fractionally over 3 in 10 people in the UK can name their Member of Parliament correctly. And Members of Parliament are actually the best known forms of politicians in the UK, and we have all these politicians from all levels of UK government.
3 in 10? That's a disappointing number. Fortunately, we can read Tom's mind to know what he's thinking.
Holy crap, they only know 3 in 10? Are they even more stupid than we thought? How can anybody ever achieve anything if they don't even know their own politician? How are they going to find out about the shiny new thing that we just built if they don't even know the name of their politician?
Really, the whole process starts before they get to this page. Some constituent gets moved to write a letter and types into a search box a question like,
who is my politician? That sort of thing. How do I write to my councillor?
If the search engine responds with a page like writetothem.com, then people are empowered. Tom reports that
44% of people who used this service last year told us that they'd never written to any politician of any kind ever before.
Okay, so if you have an issue that's important to you and you want to contact a politician, you're in good shape. But how do you figure out what's going on in government? Steinberg points to another site that fills that need. TheyWorkForYou.com, which takes
the record of what goes on in the British Parliament and turns it into a searchable, usable version of the same thing. As well as comments on the right-hand side left by users to add context to what's going on here. There are links to explain the jargon, like minister, and links through to other things which are studded into it.
Again, making the previously inaccessible accessible. When you further click on the page for a specific politician, you'll find
information on their job and their majority. And down here, we have a summary of information on how they voted, all computed automatically. Nothing you see here is editorialized. It's all aggregated. And perhaps one of the most popular things, the rebellion rate at the bottom there, just derived from voting patterns, nothing evaluative. A little bit further down the same page, you get information on whether politicians turn up to vote very much, whether they ask questions, all this sort of stuff.
So one tack is to make websites as easy to navigate as possible. Another is to help users avoid needing to visit your website at all. Can't you just notify them when something important happens? Of course you can.
There's 27,000 people signed up to They Work For You to be emailed whenever either their own politician says anything at all, or when a word or a phrase that they're interested in, maybe an issue like global warming, is mentioned by anybody in Parliament. How many services do you run where you put all the information on the internet, but you suspect that people would actually much rather just have an email drop into their box when you had something to tell them, like there's a new consultation that you're interested in, or there's a change in the law that affects you that we should maybe go and tell you about? Why don't you start setting up these sorts of email alerts? Because they're a very cheap way of building on top of the data you've already spent loads of money gathering and turning it into just simply enormously increasing the rate at which people extract value from it.
Email is a pretty solitary experience. In a way, that's what makes spam work. You don't know how many other people receive that same piece of email. Tom Steinberg talked about another site that takes advantage of the fact that we're all social creatures. He explains that
the premise of PledgeBank is that people will do things with other people that they won't do on their own. Users can create pledges, and they're always of the same kind, that say, I will do something, but only if a certain number of other people will do something. So in this little case here, I will clean up the banks of the River Taff between Western Avenue and Cardiff Castle, but only five other local people will too. People use it for all sorts of things, local and national and international. This is about getting people to agree that it's worth offsetting carbon dioxide. PledgeBank is useful because it shows how you can build tools as an entity that is maybe government or connected with government that allows the citizens to empower themselves. This doesn't actually directly involve politicians, government data in most ways. It just allows the citizens to get together and do things that they want to.
And so Tom tells civil servants to
go home, take your training budget for the tools you've just built, cut it in half, and give that half to usability consultants. The second lesson, you keep building local versions of sites because you're all local authorities and there's 470 of you and you're very proud of your local achievements, and that's good. But it's time to start chumming together into sites like Write to Them, to sites like They Work For You, putting aside your rivalries so that you get the critical mass required to really have kind of any sort of substantial success at all in this field. And lastly, government might not be the only player in your field here. Go looking for people who may be already building and running tools in this field. You may find that there are interesting partners to tell you things.
Or in other words, if you could read Tom's mind,
don't spend £4 million without talking to any of the people who've done any of the good work in this area, like you did last time.
Tom Steinberg from My Society. Can a chair be open source? Not the plans for a chair, the actual chair itself. And if so, what license should it be under? And if you copy a chair and modify it, should you be required to commit those changes back? All of this is, of course, nonsensical in the real world that most of us inhabit every day. It makes perfect sense, however, if you spend time in Second Life. Jim Perbrick is a software engineer at Linden Lab, creators of Second Life, and he begins by explaining that
Second Life is a 3D virtual world. It's a 3D space that you can inhabit as an avatar and walk around and explore and interact with. If you make something in Second Life and you leave it on the floor and then you log out and you come back in a week's time, it will still be there. It's massively multi-user. At the moment, we see 10,000 concurrent people using Second Life at the same time. Now, the really different thing about Second Life is that it's built by its residents. So most virtual worlds are built by games companies, and they're filled with content by games companies, and so people go into the virtual worlds and they go on adventures that were defined by the games companies. Second Life is completely different. Linden Lab created Second Life, and it was just an empty world to fill with whatever you like, and that's what the residents have done. So when they build the virtual world, what they're doing is they're making 3D objects, they're uploading and creating textures to texture those objects and themselves to make clothing. They are scripting the objects to make them interactive, so you can go and you can touch them, or you can talk to them, and they can respond to you. They are creating and uploading animations for their avatars. So, for instance, if they're making a golf game, they might create a golf swing animation, upload that into Second Life, and when you press go on your golf HUD, then your avatar makes a golf swing. Now, the other really important thing about this is that all the content in Second Life is owned by the residents that create it. And what that means is both that you can make something in Second Life and sell it to somebody else in Second Life for Linden dollars, which you can convert to your local currency, and it also means that you own the intellectual property rights. So obviously lots and lots and lots of people use the web every day, but less than 10% of people that use the web actually contribute to it. Less than 10% of people make web pages, write blogs, and generally create content on the web. So as the difficulty of user creation goes up, then the level of participation goes even further down. First-person shooter mods, these are things like creating levels for Quake or Doom, games where you run around and shoot things, and people create different levels for them. But very few of the people who play Quake or Doom actually create levels. Most people just use the ones that other people make. And The Sims 1 and The Sims 2 are examples of games that were designed to promote user participation, to promote people creating content for the games in virtual worlds. And again, they actually experienced very low levels of participation. So in Second Life, these are traditionally hard problems. We're asking people to create 3D objects, to create virtual humans, and this means designing the appearance and the behavior of their avatar, and we're asking them to program as well. If you want to make an interactive object in Second Life, you have to do some programming in a C-like programming language. For some reason, Second Life, even though it's very, very difficult to build content for Second Life, we actually see really, really high levels of participation, above 60%. So this is, you know, an anomaly, and we want to know why it occurs. Let's talk about some of the reasons that we may see some of this participation in Second Life. And this is by no means any kind of scientific study. As you can see, I'm waving my hands, and this is a very hand-wavy talk. But maybe these are some of the reasons that people take part in Second Life. The first one is instant gratification. We've heard this a lot in this conference, that if you want to get people to participate, they need to be able to participate really quickly and get results really quickly and see the results and have satisfaction from seeing the results. And you need to get rid of all the frustration and you need to make it as easy as possible. Now, I'm not saying Second Life is, you know, completely free of frustration, but this is a game we made at Food Camp a couple of days ago. We spent a couple of us spent a few hours in the bar hacking this game together, and it's Petanque with pianos. So we were in Belgium, we were on the continent, so we thought we'd better play Petanque. We were in Second Life, so we thought, well, why not play it with pianos and couches and four-poster beds? So we spent an hour hacking this stuff together, and then you know, we threw a jack out into the world, and we started hurling pianos at it, and it was great fun. You know, it took a couple of hours, and it was lots and lots of fun to play with. So it is you can make stuff in Second Life pretty quickly. And to make really, really professional-looking stuff obviously takes time. To make very complicated stuff is probably harder than it should be, but it's very quick to hack something together in Second Life and play around with it and have some fun. So another thing that I think is important is always on creation. So in Second Life, there is no editing mode. There's no creation mode and consuming mode. It's all on at the same time. So when you're in the world, you can make stuff all the time when you're in the world. So here we are at a 9/11 memorial concert in Second Life, and you can see someone sitting on a upturned box there, I think, playing the guitar, and they're streaming their music in Second Life, and everybody else there is listening to the concert that's going on in Second Life, and I'm very rudely here creating a plywood box and mucking around with it. But that's just to show that it can be done. And like everybody sitting here with their laptops, who is kind of maybe tweaking and building and tinkering while they're listening, you see this happen a lot in Second Life. People are at parties, and while they're at parties, the person hosting the party is going, maybe I'll just change the shape of my lampshade a bit, or maybe I'll change the wallpaper while we're kind of hanging around and having a chat. And so because you can always create, people do create. Collaborative creation is another important thing in Second Life. This is a sandbox, which is an area in Second Life that anyone's can freely use to create stuff. And there is always people here, always making stuff. It's like a 24/7, 365 days of the year maker fair. You can turn up there, you can see someone making something really weird and wacky and crazy. You can go up, you can ask them what they're doing, you can watch them building, you can ask them about how they build, and you can join in. There is also a culture of teaching in Second Life. This is the Ivory Tower of Primitives. It's an absolutely massive build in Second Life, and it's full of lessons on how to build stuff, how to stretch objects, how to texture objects, how to copy objects, how to create complex shapes out of objects. And this was built by the people in Second Life for the people in Second Life. It's also very easy to share and distribute your work. So unlike with some computer systems, you have to kind of build stuff, and then you have to make a conscious effort to upload it somewhere, distribute it, make a project page, yada, yada, yada. In Second Life, you can, if you've built it in Second Life, you can just mark it as modifiable, mark it as copyable, someone can come along, take a copy of it, and start playing around with it. So there's kind of very little friction in the distribution of work between people. So when I started thinking about this problem of this creation engine, this why, what is it in Second Life that makes people build stuff? First of all, I thought it was something like this, that Second Life was like some virtual digger or bulldozer, this kind of powerful tool that lets you build stuff. But actually, as I started thinking about it, I think it's more like this. This is the creation engine, the people in Second Life. It's not about the tools that we've given them. It's about the fact that there's this community that wants to build the world despite the tools we've given them, I think. So it's about people being able to communicate. It's about people being able to hang out. It's about people being able to build a community. And it's about people being able to participate that's important rather than the actual tools that you make them use. Because in the case of Second Life, they're not absolutely, you know, brilliant by any means. So another interesting thing is that we're potentially coming to a turning point in Second Life. So the people who've used Second Life have built this wonderful, vibrant world that you can't help reading and you can't avoid, and loads of people are talking about all over the place. And so, as a result, real world companies, real world organizations are coming into Second Life. So on the left-hand side, you've got American Apparel, who recently came into Second Life, built a virtual shop, and you can go there and you can buy virtual T-shirts for your avatar, and you can buy real T-shirts for your meat space body and have them sent to you in real life. On the other hand, you've got Creative Commons, who've turned up in Second Life, and they've gone, wow, there's this great culture of sharing and learning, and there's this Creative Commons in Second Life that already exists, and we want to promote that. And so what's going to happen in Second Life? Is it that the commercial companies are going to come in and Second Life is going to become less of an open source Creative Commons and more of a commercial place? Or is it that that Second Life is going to maintain this kind of open source thing? Well, it's probably going to be a mixture, just like it is in the real world. But on the other hand, Second Life could be a completely open source world. So in the real world, you can either distribute source code as open source, or you can distribute software as closed source. But whatever you do, there are lots of things in the world that can't be distributed as open source. This table, this laptop, they're physical objects, and I can't just magically say, okay, anyone can take a copy, and anyone can modify it. In Second Life, everything can be copyable. Everything can be modifiable. The chairs can be open source just as easily as the scripts can be open source. You can make yourself a chair in Second Life. You can decide that you're happy with it. You can sit down in it and leave it on your land. But then you can say, okay, this is copyable. This is modifiable. Anyone can take a copy. Anyone can make a better version. And maybe you'll get a better chair back. So it'll be interesting to see how things pan out in Second Life because the norms haven't solidified yet. There's lots of open source stuff going on. There's lots of commercial stuff going on. Potentially, the entire world could be an open source world.
Thanks to Jim Perbrick of Linden Lab and My Society's Tom Steinberg. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg, distributing the futures of production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro. It was run through Gigavox's Levelator at least once.